farmers market to urban farms, people are finding creative ways to connect through food. Food is an essential part of everyone's lives. It gives us the energy and nutrients to grow and develop, be healthy and active, to move, work, play, think and learn. Foods rich in protein and carbohydrates provides the body with its main source of energy. Food is an important part of cultural heritage and national identity. It can connect us to people, places, bring friends and family together. Food habits such as whether you should eat all the food on your plate vary across the globe. Good morning, and you are listening to CKMS 102.7 FM Radio Waterloo in conversation with Rashmi, bringing you your community stories. In studio this morning, joining me in conversation is Jasmine Mangala-Cyril and Amanda Case, who have made a mark for themselves in this community and beyond through food and in writing. So welcome and thank you for coming in this morning. It's a pleasure to have you both.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Good morning.
Both of you have some connection to food here, so I'm going to go with Amanda, you first. You grew up in a small town in Newfoundland, had your own challenges with growing up, and people kind of bullied, and weight was a big issue at that point. So how did fitness begin before even food began for you?
Yeah, well, actually, so I grew up in a really small town of like a couple thousand people, and we didn't have any access to resources about healthy eating. We didn't have gyms. We didn't have like our closest grocery store was probably about an hour away. So yeah, I mean, health wasn't really something that was on, you know, the top of everybody's mind. So for me, I just saw, you know, a deterioration in health in many people around me that I cared about, and I just decided I wanted a different lifestyle for myself. So I got active, started focusing on, you know, eating healthy foods and focusing on what I could control, staying away from junk food, and worked out outside. I would jog, I would just, you know, do some aerobics and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And you graduated from Laurier with an honors in kinesiology.
Yes, I did.
And you also studied holistic nutrition.
I did.
So what brought the interest? How did that even begin for you?
Yeah, so once I started working out on my own, my life completely changed. I felt so much better. And that really inspired me to keep going. And fitness was just something that was part of my life I didn't think about. It wasn't until I was in my early 20s that I discovered, hey, I could actually make a career out of doing what I love. And I went to school for kinesiology and physical education. So that's how that started. And then from there, I worked as a personal trainer, fitness instructor, and coaching people, I loved it. But I found that, you know, coaching people about movement and fitness was only one piece of the puzzle to health, and I wanted to help people further. So that's why I started studying nutrition. And I like the holistic nutrition because it looks at a very holistic perspective of health, mental, emotional, your environment, social factors that all, you know, combine our eating habits.
And for you, Jasmine, you're a local food writer who documents the culinary history. How did this journey even begin? Like, what brought you to start writing?
Well, I've always written. Always written, you know, since primary school and all of that. But the entire thing about food is I've always been the person that people asked about food. How do you cook this? What does this instruction mean? I tried this recipe and I have a whole bunch of this left over. What else can I do with it? And from there, you know, it's almost the history of the internet there, you know, the personal website started then I was asked to write for an e-zine, then, you know, this is the beginning of blogs then. Mm-hmm. I was one of Canada's first bloggers, food bloggers that is, and it just sort of developed. So at first it was more of a personal diarization of food, and then it slowly morphed into, it's not just about me, it's not about what I eat, it's about the community, and it's about what other people eat, and, you know, why are we eating this way, and, you know, what are the influences, and so that got me into foodways, which is what you're talking about, the socio-political, economic, geographic influences of how people eat.
Your work that you've been doing over a couple of months, years, into writing and also finding the history of this community and how food is linked mm-hmm. with this region or beyond, how did that begin?
Oh, goodness, you know, it crept in so slowly that it's almost difficult to figure out a starting point. Edna Stabler has always been an influence in this area, and she and I became friends later in her life. But knowing, you know, you go to the market and you see the Mennonites in their buggies, you know the strong agricultural roots in this area, but then also knowing that we have a very strong industrial history with food, whether it's Schneider's or Dare Cookies or Seagram's, you know, many, many other food, Smiles and Chuckles, the old chocolate factory. Yeah, exactly. You know, so it's always been around. It's always been something that I've known about. And when people come into this area, I'll just whip off something, say, you know, oh, yeah, and this is what this was. They say, wait a minute, how did you know that? You know, if you talk about the history of Prohibition and, you know, what happened in this area very specifically, with, you know, say the Kuntz Brewery, Seagram's Brewery, you know, the tunnels underneath King Street that went from the Huther to what used to be a garage and all of that. So it always sort of was there, and it just sort of started building and building. And then, you know, a few years ago, I decided to look at foodways from a very specific time frame, World War I and 1916, and the name change from Berlin to Kitchener. And so that's where I really started looking into a few more very specific local things.
Did you find a huge difference in the transition from when this change happened with the food?
It's not necessarily a transition. Everything is an evolution. So for the 1916 project, just looking at the influences of how our community ate. So what that was basically what I did was I went through the English language newspapers of the day and looked at the political events that were happening, not just about the name change or amalgamation, but, you know, the war, how that influenced how people ate, looking at even the recipes in the newspapers at the time, you know, very different influences from what we have today. But at the same time, back then, there was a lot more nationalism, a lot more patriotism, in quotations, about what people were eating. And, you know, also the ingredients that were available. You know, the food reflects the people. So it was a lot of Western culture, a lot of Western cuisines, though I didn't see any recipes from, say, Portugal or from China or from India or anywhere else. Unlike today, when you open up the Record, you open up the Star, you open up the Globe and Mail, you're finding such diverse recipes and diverse eating habits, you know. So yeah, it's an evolution, and it's a slow one, and you know, food is one of those things that reflects the community. So yeah,
absolutely. And for you, Amanda, food has played a big part in your life as well, where you know, you decided, okay, you went on to become a manager for corporate wellness programs at various companies, and that kind of transitioned into, at the back of your mind, you always had this dream that you wanted to start a restaurant, you wanted to get into the food industry. So how did that journey begin for you?
Well, I would say really young. My dad went to cooking school, and he was just very passionate about cooking. My family in general, everything has always been about home-cooked meals, everything from scratch. Family dinner was huge. And so that started really young. When I went to university, I was, of course, on a student budget. So meal prep was a huge part of my life. I would meal prep every single week, and I would batch cook for myself. And that way I ensured that I had healthy meals ready to go. And, you know, I stayed on track with my budget, and I stayed on track with my health goals. So one day, just through, I guess, consulting with thousands of people through corporate wellness, I realized, you know, there's a lot of people that really struggle with meal prep and staying on track with healthy eating and staying on track with budgeting for having healthy food, because often we're running out and we're grabbing things when we're not prepared, right? So that's really when I had the idea for MVP Meals, and I decided, you know, I wanted to find a way to bring what I've always been doing for myself to the community and help other people that struggle with meal prep as well.
Mm-hmm. So to help understand what really meal prep is, could you just tell us what it comprises of and what meal prep is all about?
Yeah, of course. So meal prep is basically prepping batches of food, usually 2 days per week in bulk, Things like, you know, cooking large batches of rice, oatmeal for breakfast, vegetables, prepping vegetables. You know, you can do a lot of prep in advance and then just cook daily, or you can actually prep out all of your meals, put them into take-o containers, so your meals are basically grab and go. That's basically what meal prep is.
Mm-hmm. And you partnered this with another person, Nikki?
Nikki. So Nikki is my business partner. We started this about 3.5 years ago. So I didn't know anything about cooking, really, other than for myself. But Nikki had that professional background, and mm-hmm. she's so talented. She also owns Caribbean Kitchen, right in the Kitchener Market as well. So we just brought together our passions. Mine is healthy eating and meal prep and wellness education, wanting to help people. And Nikki's was, you know, making food taste amazing. So I was always about, you know, how do we get food out there that is really nutritionally balanced, right? Has, you know, the right ingredients, uses healthier ingredients to flavor food and to cook with and whatnot. And Nikki was all about, okay, great. Now what, you know, proportions do we need to also make this delicious, which mm-hmm. I'm on board with, because, you know, who wants to eat healthy food if it doesn't taste good? So we
absolutely
really need to make healthy food pleasurable, enjoyable, and mm-hmm. something that people want to eat and keep a part of their life.
Yeah, and today with the kind of options we have, keto, gluten-free, it's hard to keep up sometimes, you know, with the variations that people need and request for.
100%.
So, and also make them tasty enough mm-hmm. for their palates, right? So how do you handle that part?
Yeah, we cater in special diets, just because growing up, I grew up in a celiac family, and I really saw, you know, the struggle of people enjoying life and family events with food allergies. So that really inspired me to have a business where people that have food allergies can feel comfortable, because I know for me, being, you know, gluten-free, not by choice, by necessity, sometimes, you know, certain places are just not welcoming about your food allergies, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to create an environment that was very welcoming, and people could, you know, say I'm dairy-free, soy-free, gluten-free, whatever-free, and, you know, I'm just like, we got you, like, we'll make something for you, right? So
mm-hmm.
so that's how that started.
And Jasmine, from the different variations we have in the market today to the history that you've been writing for the past few years that you've been in this industry, how has measurements have changed, the ingredients have changed, the names have changed? So how does that vary from what it used to be in the past to where things are today? How different are they?
Ingredients, basically, the differences are what people are exposed to. I mean, post-World War II, you had a big influence of, or influx of immigration. So people who were coming in from other countries mm-hmm. Were bringing their foods and their recipes with them. And then again, in the late 60s, you know, early 70s, with another change to immigration laws in Canada, you saw even more people from the islands, from India, you know, come in with, you know, their foods. As far as, you know, things like, you know, changing names and whatnot, a lot of that is marketing.
Do you think?
A lot of it is marketing.
Okay.
You know, we used, you know, 5 years ago we had veggie burgers, you know, they're not called veggie burgers anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You know, now they're plant-based, you know, and then whatever brand it is.
Mm-hmm.
Even there, I'm drawing a blank on the recipe, but we know something today as twice baked potatoes, which is, you know, potatoes that you've baked, scooped them out, made them all fluffy like mashed potatoes, and put them back in the oven.
Mm-hmm.
They had the equivalent back, you know, 100 years ago, but they called it something different.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I think some of it is marketing, and some of it, names change to make people maybe feel comfortable if it's a different culture and it's a different food.
Sure. And for people who want to go back and try recipes from the past, and, you know, that would be a challenge, because if they're going to try and find the ingredients that are listed there that are not in sync with them, how do they figure that out?
You know, I find it's not the ingredients that are the issue, it's the measurements.
Okay.
You know, a teaspoon today is 5 ml. I found a research paper about Victorian food in which I'm just going to round the number, in which they said the teaspoon was about three and a half, so three quarters of a teaspoon, two thirds of a teaspoon today. Back then, you would say put a wine glass of something in.
Okay.
And we
that's
know.
Kind of measuring.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I'm looking at my half liter, you know, cup of coffee here, and that's probably what some people drink as one wine glass today, whereas before it was just, you know, a few ounces. Mm-hmm. So things have changed, but also from culture to culture. We have, for example, the 250 ml cup, which is pretty standard for a lot of countries. The U.S. has a smaller cup measure. You know, it's 236, usually rounded to 240. But also, you know, in India, you know, I have a cookbook from an Indian cookbook writer. And they brought it over to the States, and it said 5 cups of water or 1 liter. That's 50 ml less per cup.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's, you know, so you... Unfortunately, a lot of it is by practice. It's not necessarily intuitive. So you sort of figure things out as you do it. And then, you know, every once in a while I do get questions from people saying, I have this recipe. It's not working. It doesn't taste the way my grandmother made it. Or, you know, my auntie made it. Or, you know, in one case, my friend said, my two aunts are fighting over this recipe because neither one of them can make it taste like the way their mother made it. You know, and I said, well, you know, part of it is the ingredients, yes. Mm-hmm. But look at your measurements.
Absolutely, absolutely. And that's the challenge many of us face, right? Trying to figure out, okay, why didn't my recipe turn out the way it should? Mm-hmm. Clearly because measurements have changed or it fluctuates between books and magazines and what we've got from the past or the present. So what are some examples of building community through food that you have found in Amanda in your, you know, having the 3 years at the Kitchener Market, you have MVP meals there. So how has community been a part of your restaurant, the food there, and what you've been doing?
Yeah, community is really our entire focus in terms of what we do, especially being at the Kitchener Market. I love the sense of community there. You know, the history behind the Kitchener Market and the ongoing support, it's really incredible. So I like to always make sure that, you know, I'm aware of what's happening in the community, you know, in terms of diets that are really popular. Like we recently embraced the keto diet because there's a huge keto community in Kitchener. So for me, being aware of what's happening in the community and, you know, staying focused on how we can support people in the community with their dietary needs. So always being aware of that. And of course, yeah, just keeping connected with different events that are happening inside and outside of the Kitchener Market as well.
Mm-hmm. You also do meats and vegetarian options, right?
Yeah, well, I do see a huge trend in terms of people wanting to have more meatless options. Our customers have been requesting it for quite some time. So we've, you know, are still establishing our vegan menu and our vegan menu, I guess, online with the meal delivery as well as inside the Kitchener Market. I do see a lot of people with flexible eating. So, you know, they aren't necessarily a vegan or a vegetarian, but they do want more meatless options. So people will order meal packages that are maybe 5 meals with meat, 5 meals that are vegetarian. And we recently did a vegan barbecue, which was very successful. Nice. So we did a 3-course vegan barbecue at the market. And I think people like options. Options are always good when it comes to food and, mm-hmm. and diets too.
Yeah. And Jasmine, the food column for the Grand Magazine that you've been writing for, it tells stories of people who have come to Waterloo region and the food kind of reminds them of their home. What kind of stories do people talk about? Is it the food that, you know, they grew up with, or is it the food that they've cultivated in this region? What's the food column all about?
Well, I describe it as the intersections of immigration, memory, and food. So, yes. You know, what it is people who've come here, everyone comes with a story. Everyone comes here for a reason, whether they are fleeing something or you're either running from or running to something is mm-hmm. essentially what it is.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, I sit and I talk to them, and they tell me what they want to tell me about their family history, you know, why they came here. And, you know, sometimes it gets a little poignant, You know, there are stories that are difficult to tell or difficult to remember, you know, whether it's things that happened to a grandparent or things that happened to parents, you know, escaping war, or just looking for new opportunities. And then, you know, when you're here, you know, food is one of those things that keeps you rooted to those memories of friends, of family, of home, of tradition. So, you know, it's usually an adaptation of foods that they grew up with. And it can be anything from a soup to a I'm getting a lot of stews right now. You know, grilled foods. Right now I'm working on a dessert for the holidays. You know, it's the publishing and magazine process. I mean, at the end of the month, I need to submit for a November-December publication date. So yeah, so right now it's Christmas at my place, and you know, it's what, 26 degrees outside pretty soon. So yeah.
So when people share these stories with you about, you know, the culture and the history, a lot of them also find isolation plays a huge part. So do you think food is comforting in some way to fight that isolation and the whole part where they miss that culture and family?
I think it does. I think it does, especially with people who have children, because they want to make sure that their children grow up attached to some way to, you know, their grandparents or their great-grandparents or whatever. You know, and then in the area, we have more than 100, I think it's more than 140 ethnicities in Waterloo Region.
Wow.
You know, so that's ethnicities versus nationalities, right? And so we have these small pockets of, you know, people, and we always gravitate towards one another, right? So, you know, whether you're, say, a Bengali, or you know, you're a Syrian Arabic speaking person, or whatever, you will gravitate towards one another, and then you share and you talk and you remember. So those recipes, I think to a certain extent help, but at the same time, once, you know, people start making friends and connections to other cultures, then it begins to share, and then the recipes begin to evolve, you know. So you'll see, you know, a Hungarian take on, you know, a Chinese dish, for example, you know, that sort of thing. Or they'll say, like there's a restaurant in town that serves Uyghur food, and the Uyghurs are an area in China that's the most western part of China, and it's, they border Afghanistan and Central Asia and the rest of it. And you know, I reviewed them for the record a couple of years ago, and I had a friend go with me, and she said, "These hand-cut noodles are exactly like my grandmother's noodles."
Really? Wow.
And, you know, my friend is Hungarian. And, you know, so, you know, you do the research and the rest, and wait a minute, there are links and there are connections. So it's, in some cases, it's, we're not as different as people want to think we are.
We all interconnected in some way or the other, right?
Yeah.
That's very true. And with your rye and ginger.
Yes.
What is rye and ginger all about?
Rye and ginger, I started for the 1916 project, which is the one where we looked at, or where I looked at the name change and the issues and the food issues of the time. But I very specifically looked at, chose rye and ginger because it represents a couple of things. Rye, as in our distilling history, so with Seagram's and the rest of it, and ginger, for two reasons. One, for the wild ginger, so a nod to, you know, our indigenous populations here, but also with the influx of new people and people, you know, from China and from India and Southeast Asia and other places. So that's where the name came from. The site originally started as what I was hoping to be a pure foodways site, but look, starting with the 1916 project. After 1916, I began a project called a region that really schmecks, which is again, but these were first-person interviews, first-person stories of people in the community talking about their history and the food, and you know, a recipe that means something to them. So you know, I started doing that, and then the restaurant reviewing came in. So I can't do everything.
Yes. we only have that much time in a day and two hands that we can function
right.
with.
So, you know, Ryan Ginger is you know, a little slow right now, but I do populate it with links to the Grand Column and other things. So,
And on that link and that website, there are a lot of stories of real people who have shared the traditions, cultures that go way back to when they were young or, you know,
even generations before them. Yes.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
So if people need to look at that and, you know, read about it, are there also recipes put up there of what people have spoken about?
Yes. Yes. Both the Grand Column and, well, and the Food That Really Schmecks, each article has a recipe provided by the interviewee.
Mm-hmm.
Or by the subject. And, you know, I generally don't tell them, you give me a recipe on this. I'll say something like, okay, well, this is for the November-December issue, which is traditionally the holiday issue. So maybe something that fits that. Or, you know, this is going to be a summer issue, so maybe not a stew this time, but let's try something different. So I try to make it and try to get food that's appropriate to when the article will be seen, but also make it so that people at home can try it.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of adventuresome cooks out there.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they want to try different things. They want to, you know, maybe expand their culinary repertoire. And as a recipe writer, you know, I basically take a lot of recipes that, you know, I'm not sure how you two write recipes, but, you know, a lot of it with me and my notes at home is cook until done. You know, translate that into mm-hmm. today's culinary language for today's home cooks
mm-hmm.
who may not have, you know, a lot, who may never have taken a home ec course, you know, who may not have learned how to cook at, you know, their uncle's or their aunties or their mm-hmm. grandmother's knee. So try to make them accessible. That way too.
And Amanda, for you, you've spent a decade coaching people on healthy living as a wellness consultant. So when people come to you, a wellness consultant, what was your challenge trying to accommodate their needs for the kind of food they were eating? Because for me, I find a big struggle with sweets, right? Like, that's my biggest weakness. How does one balance food with wellness here?
Yeah, I mean, you know, typically my approach, like, everybody is so different, and that's why there's no, you know, one size fits all plan or diet. So mm-hmm. anytime I've worked with somebody, it's a pretty extensive process that I want to know, like, everything about them, right? So that way I can make appropriate recommendations, right, for their lifestyle, for their culture, for their family life, for their work, for their challenges and their goals, right? Those are all of the things that I look at. So everybody is very unique, and
And even mental health plays a big part in the food we eat today, right? So 100%. How does that play into all of this?
I typically will approach different people differently, of course, because, you know, some people may be ready to make many changes at once. Many people are just ready to make one change at a time, small steps, small goals. So it really depends on the person and what they're willing to take on at that time.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I definitely, you know, as I'm working with people over time and establishing that relationship and that, you know, professional bond, I make recommendations as we basically evolve, right? So depending on what somebody's goal is, like if somebody wants to lose weight and maybe they are already exercising, then we may not focus on that. It might be, let's take a look at your diet for a few days and then I can make some recommendations on that. Or sometimes people are eating really well and they're exercising and mental health, emotion, stress are a factor in terms of weight. So there's so many different things to look at.
Mm-hmm. So how do you balance working at the restaurant and doing the wellness part with the corporate world? It's too different because you need to be at, you know, the Kitchener Market where your MVP meals are. It's a 5-day week, is it? How does?
Yeah, so we're open Tuesdays to Saturdays and mm-hmm. I wellness consult 3 days a week. So mm-hmm. I have a team.
So it plays a big role even on yourself, right? Like to balance both the industry that you're in and juggle appointments. You also cater to a lot of places. So
yeah.
How do you, as a person, keep calm? Like, is there anything you would like to help our listeners understand? Like, what is your magic wand there?
Oh, gosh. Mindset is everything, right? The things that we say to ourselves. And for me, becoming really conscious of what my thoughts are. And setting the intentions for the day and keeping focused for the day. So I do have a high performance planner that has been a lifesaver. It helps me focus on my to-do list for the day, you know, helps me really focus on my mindset first thing in the morning, and in the evening as well. I focus on gratitude, just reflecting on the day and what I'm grateful for and all of that. So that helps to really keep my mindset in check. So mindset is really key, having that positive mindset and being aware of how you look at challenges. Because, you know, I could look at things and say, oh my gosh, you know, this is so stressful or so challenging, so hard, I'll never be able to do it. Or I could look at the exact same thing and be like, okay, this is what has to get done. This is how I'm going to do it. Right? So mindset is really key.
Mm-hmm. And for Jasmine, what about you? What's your magic wand that keeps you going on a day-to-day basis? Because in this rat race in today's world, everyone's trying to, you know, get through the day, get through what we finish. So how does one stay focused and keep going?
Coffee.
Yes, lots of coffee.
Coffee is a good thing. But you know what? I think it's really training yourself to figure out what you need to weed out in your life. Mm-hmm. You know, and that can be a difficult decision for some people, especially when you're pulled in so many directions. I don't have children, you know, so, if you have parents and kids and, you know, you have a job and you have a part-time thing and you're doing community work and the rest of it, you're pulled in so many directions. Sometimes you have to be true to yourself and know what it is you can do and what it is you can't do. Mm-hmm. And you can't be everything to everybody.
Absolutely.
You know, you need to be able to say no to people at times. And a lot of it, I think, especially being a female entrepreneur, because I am a communications consultant as well, is being able to say, you know, this is my value, this is my worth. And, you know, I get a number of requests from people who, you know, want me to work with them or work for them, but they're not willing to recognize my value. Mm-hmm. You know, so, you know, they want me to write for like a Fiverr type fee versus what my work is really worth. So, you know, being able to recognize your own value is a really big, important thing. And as individuals, we have to see our own values.
Mm-hmm. In today's times, again, authenticity plays a huge part, especially with the food industry. Being authentic with the recipes and authentic in what goes in there and not kind of copy-paste from here and say, it's my recipe. Do you see any of those? And is that a challenge?
Well, authenticity is I'm hearing two things. Mm-hmm. I'm hearing authenticity versus plagiarism.
Okay. Yeah, they kind of go hand in hand.
You know, so yeah. Authenticity, one has to remember that anything in culture is it's organic. Music is organic. Writing is organic. Food is organic in the sense that, you know, say I went over to your place and you cooked me this awesome gluten-free meal, I might say, hey, how did you do that? And, you know, how could you get the texture right with that cake? And then I'll go, wait a minute, I can adapt that technique to my standard cake over here, just as a very big example sort of thing. Mm-hmm. But also with, you know, a lot of people get hung up on the word authenticity. And authenticity is a very scary word when it comes to cooking, when it comes to food, because some people, how can that be authentic? You didn't use, you know, this certain type of hand grinder to make your herb mix. Mm-hmm. You know, I've talked to people like that. Foods adapt, techniques change, you know. There are people who will say, because I use a blender to make my garlic ginger chili paste, that's not authentic because I'm not pounding it by hand.
Yes, right? Absolutely.
Right? So there are people who will go to that extreme. But, you know, when you come to why shouldn't we embrace technology? You know, if it's going to save time, it's going to save, you know, agony and the rest of it, why not? But as far as plagiarism goes, just mm-hmm. to maybe talk about the other part of that yes. question. You know, copyright and recipe writing, there's a special relationship there. You can't copyright the list of ingredients, but you can copyright the description, you know, of the method, for example.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So, you know, shortbread, a traditional shortbread is butter, sugar, and flour, you know, but the copyrightable part of it is the method.
Okay.
You know, and if you have a very, you know, wonky, very, you know, name for your recipe, one can say, okay, you know, there are two places that, you know, there are two people who are calling their shortbreads, you know, the blue and white cup shortbread. you know, that'll be kind of eh. So traditionally, recipe writers and food people are very giving and very good people. we're very encouraging of other people, and we like to see our recipes used. But you know, when we start seeing our work lifted verbatim and mm-hmm. then put into a cookbook,
mm-hmm.
or
have you had that happen?
I have had recipes, I will say, stolen by marketers. The first time it happened was a company out in Ottawa.
Wow.
I had written a series on the history of vanilla and the processing and all of that. And I had, you know, this is how you make vanilla extract, this is how you make vanilla sugar, you know, very basic vanilla sort of condiments or whatever. And I all of a sudden found out that this company had taken my posts, you know, taken my words and put them in their marketing materials, and also the photographs.
Oh, wow.
I've also had newspapers take my recipes.
Mm-hmm.
In one case, they took my photo and my recipe, the photo of the food and the recipe, but they cut off my copyright attribution on the
wow.
photograph. So it does happen.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's when you start getting your lawyers out. And it's especially now that the internet and blogging and feeds and whatnot, it's so easy to spread this information.
Absolutely.
It's also easy for the unscrupulous amongst us to take it and then do what they want with it.
Mm-hmm.
So it can be, you know, for some people it is literally a full-time job keeping an eye on what they've put out there.
Absolutely. And that's a challenge in itself, right? Like, as good as technology and media and everything is today, it's also a scary place because
mm-hmm.
you don't know what goes out, what stays in, and
true.
How do you keep track of it? It's all over the place. So
you know, and it really is too bad. As I said, you know, a lot of us are very good and kind people, but it's just that, you know, that 2% or whatever the percentage is
mm-hmm.
who aren't that, you know, spoil the soup.
And Amanda, with MVP Meals, help our listeners understand where they can find the details and what they can order from and what are the foods that you supply. Can you give us a little detail about that?
Of course. All of our information is on our website, www.mvpmeals.com. And, of course, we're on social media, Facebook, Instagram. Our handle is @MVPMeals. And, of course, we're inside the Kitchener Market Tuesday to Saturday, 8 a.m. to 3 p.m. And you can stop by and talk to one of us in person. And, of course, you can call us, email us with any questions. We do meal packages. We've branched out into office catering daily for breakfast, lunch, snacks. We do fridge stocking and whatnot for various companies.
What is fridge stocking?
Fridge stocking. So we'll deliver a selection of lunches and or dinners, and then employees just grab and go.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So that's a big thing for a lot of companies now. They want to offer lunches or breakfasts for, am I saying that right? Breakfasts?
I'm not going to be the grammar queen today.
Not today. Okay.
Not today.
yeah. So anyway, just that's a huge thing that's really popular right now and that we're keeping quite busy with.
So what are your popular menus on the go?
Yeah, so what you tried, the Buddha bowl, is super popular. We do a vegan version of that. And I love Buddha bowls because you can pack a ton of nutrition and fun ingredients into a bowl. And it's quite tasty. So, I really can pack a ton of nutrition. They're exciting. They're really visually appealing. We sell a lot of those at the Kitchener Market and also inside the meal delivery as well. So that's popular. And then people love our zoodles. So we spiralize zucchini into noodles. And people will have stir fries over that, or they'll also will make spaghetti sauce and put that over zucchini noodles. We'll do Alfredo. We'll do what we call power pasta, which is basically a bunch of delicious sautéed veggies with a variety of Italian herbs, and then we make our own sun-dried tomato cream pasta sauce, put that over zucchini noodles. So yeah, we're always trying to just find creative ways to cater to different diets and have fun with food.
That's awesome. And Jasmine, you are also a restaurant reviewer.
I am.
So with Amanda having a restaurant here, what are the things that goes into being a restaurant reviewer, or what is it that you do?
Right. Okay. So for people who aren't in the region, the Waterloo Region Record is a little different from a lot of newspapers out there. We have a team of three reviewers, and so we're in a cycle. So each one of us looks for different things. We come with different experiences, different food traditions, and we apply those to how we assess a restaurant. And we actually had an interesting project at the beginning of the year where the three of us went to the same restaurant and sat at the same table, and then we reviewed the experience from our points of view.
Okay.
And they were three very different reviews and three different ratings.
Oh, interesting.
Yes. You know, but for me, you know, it's real. First and foremost, I'm there for the food. Mm-hmm. There's no question about it. Mm-hmm. You know, I know there are people who think that, you know, the decor is really important and the service is really important, and they do impact. But it's really about the food. You know, is it well prepared? Did it come out on time? Is what was in the description what I actually have in front of me? Mm-hmm. You know, it's very basic that way. But, you know, the service, you know, how were we treated? What's the accessibility like? And accessibility is a big thing in this in this age right now.
Absolutely.
It's not just about wheelchairs. It also includes sound and light, and you know, how much space is there between tables. I just went to a place for another review, and my companion said, she doesn't want to go to a certain restaurant because they're all high top tables and those tall bar stool type.
Oh,
you know, it's really difficult. And you know, she's able-bodied,
mm-hmm.
but it's just difficult because you know we're properly heighted people. We're not 5 foot, you know, three giants.
Yes.
You know, so it's difficult. You know, things like that. But for me, you know, there are just a couple of different things that I've sort of focused on. Is, you know, I have to experience the food through its own lens. It can't be what I want it to be. Mm-hmm. You know, I have to understand what it is that the restaurant is trying to do. You know, I have to go in without prejudice. You know, there's no point in me going into a place going, oh, well, it's a diner. There's no way this place can ever serve good food. Or, oh, this is a place that, you know, has always gotten 15 stars out of, you know, 14. Therefore, it's going to be a wonderful experience.
Mm-hmm. And restaurants are also, they can be quite expensive.
Yes, they can.
When you go out and, you know, you have
to
eat that meal. So.
Yep. Yes, they can.
You know, does that also be a part of the review when you review about how expensive a place is or not?
Well, I mean, what I do, I look at the restaurant and the food section as part of the newspaper as an entirety, and the record is the newspaper of record, mm-hmm. For the community. So it has to be reflective, the food section has to be reflective of what's happening here. So I look at restaurants at various price points, but our mandate is a three-course meal for two. So that's a lot. That's more food than I would normally eat, you know. you know, I usually just have a main, and, you know, if I'm feeling like it, maybe a bit of a dessert.
Yeah.
But, you know, there is a value is one of those things that people automatically gravitate to. And because I am a cook, I do know the complexity of, you know, how certain dishes are made. That does play a factor into it. I mean, if you're charging me $25 for something that's, you know, but at the same time, the final bill, it's part of it is the value there. But, you know, how do I feel at the end of the day? Do I want to go back to it? Mm-hmm. You know, do I want to return? You know, am I happy? That's one big question I have. Am I happy at the end of that meal?
Yep, absolutely. Yeah. Satisfying. Did you like it? Did you enjoy the food? Was the ambience? Was it
back? Would you recommend?
Yeah, exactly. You know, what was the, you know, did they treat me right? You know, did they treat me well?
That's so important, too.
You know, I mean, I've been at both ends of the scale where, you know, they're like, how dare you be in my place, to we want to treat you like family.
Absolutely. Yeah. So if people need to reach out and read about your stuff, where can they find you?
The restaurant reviews are in The Record. Okay. So the website is www.therecord.com. And if you go into the What's Happening section, the column is called Dining Out, and as I said, there are three of us who do this. The World of Food column for Grand Magazine is on Grand as well, and that's grandmagazine.ca, I think. I'm sorry, Brian, if you're listening. Brian is my editor. But those articles do sometimes appear in The Record and are sometimes picked up by other newspapers, you know, the Toronto Star or the Metroland newspapers.
And
that
if people want to follow you, they
do. If you want to follow me, every social media thing I'm on has the same name, which is great, and it's Cardamom Addict, CardamomAddict. So you can find me on Instagram, Facebook, and on Twitter, and I do like my Twitter.
Awesome. Mm-hmm. And Amanda, you're also on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter, right?
Twitter as well, yeah.
As MVP Meals?
Yep, at MVP Meals.
Great. Thank you so much, Jasmine and Amanda, for sharing some wonderful information and giving us a better understanding and how we look at food today and its importance. Thanks so much for being here in studio with me.
Thanks for having us, and thanks for listening.
You can also follow me on my Facebook page, In Conversation with Rashmi, or my Instagram feed at RASHSANJ. Thank you for listening. In Conversation with Rashmi.